WOO Portland.
Today on Wings, women around the world have traditions for reuse and recycling, but modern consumption patterns spur them to organize.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to this edition of the Wings Radio Show. This is Smita Ramanathan with my colleague Manju Venkat from Bangalore, India.
Hello, dear listeners. You heard that? This is the cry of the recycling man asking for people to sell him old paper, plastic, batteries, and what not. It is a commonly heard cry in most Indian towns and cities. He buys these from the households and sells them to agents who in turn sell them to recyclers. There is a well-established recycling industry in India that recycles plastics, old furniture, e-waste, clothes, shoes and many such items. However, as our consumption goes up, the recycling industry is no longer able to take in all the waste that is generated. Quite a bit of solid waste, therefore, now ends up in landfills.
I'm sure you remember a time from our childhood, Manju, right? When we practiced thrift and conservation?
Oh yes, when consumption was so little that there was very little waste.
Let us listen to Indu Ramesh talk about her childhood, which was some 7 decades ago. Indu Ramesh is a former director with India's public sector broadcaster, All India Radio. Hers is probably a familiar voice to regular listeners of Wings, for she has been a producer on Wings.
Mother used to make a chutney out of skin of cucumber, for example. That would be made into a chutney. I know my children or grandchildren think that we were all very poor, that's why we were doing it. But I don't think so. It was a question of being thrifty, using everything that could be used, no throwing away.
But then, that was in the past, and there's never going to be a yesterday once again. We have to deal with our today as best as we can. And the reality today is that we have a mounting garbage crisis in most of our cities.
India's apostle of non-violent struggle, Gandhi, was also a champion of sanitation. At the height of India's struggle for freedom from British, he had once declared that sanitation is more important than political independence. He was against the practice of manual scavenging, a practice where people from the lowest strata of society, the so-called lower castes, were made to do the odious task of cleaning human excreta from dry toilets. In order to break the practice of manual scavenging by only the lower castes, he took upon himself the responsibility of cleaning toilets, literally dirtying his hands, doing a job that no one wanted to do.
On today's show, we talked to a few women from Bangalore who have taken upon themselves the task of managing solid waste in their communities and neighborhoods, doing a job that no one wants to do. These are women who manage the waste in their own homes, in their apartment complexes and neighborhoods. They are also volunteers, entrepreneurs and champions pushing the cause of effective solid waste management in this city.
Bangalore is a city of over 10 million people. Conservative estimates put the quantity of solid waste generated at around 4 to 5 tons in a day. The city's civic body, the Bruhat Bengaluru Mahanagarapalike or BBMP, is responsible for managing and disposing of the waste. In spite of some facilities of segregation, composting of organic waste and recyclers, large quantities end up in landfills. These landfills are nothing but lands in villages surrounding Bangalore. This is where citizen initiatives off the grid gain importance. Off the grid in this case, meaning citizens do not depend on the civic authorities to deal with their waste. They deal with and dispose of it themselves, sending zero or minimal waste to landfills. More than 25 years ago, when there was little awareness in India of waste segregation at source, Indu Ramesh started a waste management initiative in her apartment complex. She talks of how and why she started.
The builders had built the flats in an area in my city, Bangalore, which was not under the municipality. Every corner had a dustbin, but there was no proper management of waste collection. An organization called Waste Wives was doing this job in other places in the city. They helped me set up my own unit.
Waste Wives helped her set up a composting unit to compost organic waste, which is kitchen waste. And they connected her with recyclers who would buy the dry waste. She enlisted the help of 4 rag-picking boys who collected waste from about 100 households. They composted the wet waste in a compost pit and sold the dry waste to recyclers. The compost too was sold. Though it worked fairly well, she did face some protest initially.
Of course, I had to face some protest from ladies and also from men. Why are you worried about the waste? It goes out. Dogs eat the kitchen waste, so what are you worried about? But I persisted on this and I started collecting kitchen waste from about 100 flats. Then these boys would help me compost it in the compost pit. Fortunately, 25 years ago, there was not so much plastic to go into waste.
Households had to pay a collection charge each. This money, along with the money earned from selling the waste and compost, was used to pay the rag picker boys. On asking why the residents protested, Indu says,
waste as such is something that now somebody else has to worry about. I don't have to worry. In most of our South Indian houses, we sweep the floor, we wipe it with wet cloth and all that. But most of the time in small villages and towns we have seen, the waste would just be outside the house. If there was a system of street cleaning or anything, that would also be cleaned by the municipality or the local government or something. But waste was always an outside matter. See, for me, waste is something I throw out. Why should I worry about it? Let somebody else manage it.
Indu acknowledges that today things have changed. There is greater awareness about the need for segregation and better management of the waste that we generate.
Savita Hiremat is a member of the Bangalore Solid Waste Management Roundtable, a citizens' forum that creates awareness about better waste management practices and lobbies with the government for effective policies. She worked as a journalist for more than 12 years and then taught in a journalism school. Today, she's a blogger writing on waste management, an entrepreneur offering solutions to apartment complexes, and leads the waste management effort in her own apartment. Let us listen to her.
We moved into this apartment in 2011. It's Shobha Althea and Azalea, located in Yelahanka, the north side of Bangalore. So when I came here, only two-way segregation was going on, that is wet and dry. And there was a composting system, but it wasn't working efficiently. But prior to this, I had lived in an apartment called Brigade Regency in Malleshwaram. And that I was a very, very sincere segregator there. They were one of the first apartments in Bangalore to go off the grid. Yeah, they were doing their own composting. They were, say, reselling, dry waste, plastic paper and all that was being sent for as raw material to factories and all. And the third thing, only sanitary waste was being sent through BBMP.
BBMP is the acronym for Brihat Bengaluru Mahanagarapalike, the local term for the Greater Bangalore Municipal Corporation. It is the civic body that is responsible for managing the city's waste. Savita continues.
And I complain like millions do, even today. I have my work to do. Why would I do this? You know, it is BBMP's job, not my job. I'm paying my taxes, all these things, But still, I didn't want to be one complaining.
And so, Savita agreed to help set up the waste management system in her apartment. This was in October 2012, when BBMP had passed its first legislation regarding waste management that mandated segregation of waste at source and composting of organic material at the site itself.
Initially, yes, I had for 1 or 2 days I had problems with that. I mean, how am I going to do this much? I was a working woman with a little child. And then since I had some knowledge about segregating waste, and I thought, let me just start.
Many apartment complexes started following these rules.
That law, when it came into force, we made use of that. We exploited it to the hilt, and we told the community that, look, you know, this is the law and we have to follow it. And luckily, there was quite a responsive crowd here, barring 1 or 2 complaints. Everything fell in place within a week, but we didn't know what to do with the wet waste, all the organic waste that sort of piled up in one corner. Then, you know, whatever the system we had was inadequate. So I had to work with, I started doing experiments. I come from rural background, and you know, my parents do come from a farming community actually. But still, composting in an urban setting is a very, very different challenge. It's entirely different. You can't just use the same village methods here to do it. I did all that, you know, I thought that would work without having any prior knowledge.
Use a lot
of cow dung and, you know, layer it and all those things. Try to do vermicomposting using kitchen waste. All the 6 experiments failed spectacularly. And by then, already almost 18 months had passed in which, you know, I was bumping from one failed experiment to another. So basically, everything is going on well there. Segregation is going on well. And here there's this thing, loads of kitchen waste is coming. So experiment after experiment, you know, all these things were going on. Luckily, I finally got to work with one company, and they needed raw material and space to conduct their experiment. So they asked for my help. I agreed, and we together worked on it, and it sort of became success.
There are now firms in Bangalore that offer waste management solutions to households, apartment complexes, as well as corporate and business houses. Savita talks about the categories of waste.
The most ideal way of segregation in India is 3-tier segregation is fine enough. One is wet waste, green waste rather.
Mm-hmm.
Your kitchen and garden, your boutique garden, wherever, anything that lived once can go in there, or that can be composted, can go in
organic
there.
Organic waste
is also? Organic, basically organic, biodegradable waste. Second comes dry waste, is what we call it. It is basically paper, plastic, metal waste, e-waste, or fabric waste, whatever, all these things, whatever that can be recycled.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main thing. Whatever that can't be recycled will go into the third bin. That is basically sanitary bin.
Mm-hmm.
In that, of course, diapers and sanitary pads and all other anything like, discarded medicines and condoms and hospital waste, medical waste from home, everything can go into the third reject bin, which should not be touched by another person.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually goes for incineration.
Mm-hmm.
So the first bin, green waste, can be composted. Dry waste can be sent for recycling. And the third reject bin has to go for incineration. That is the method. Luckily in India, unlike in Japan where there are those many categories, here what happens is the green waste and the reject waste are, you know, on their own. They don't need further, categorization. Further segregation, secondary segregation is not needed. But for the middle one, that is dry waste, you need secondary segregation.
Mm-hmm.
So what has been happening in all over in Bangalore or even elsewhere in India is it is the housekeepers who do the secondary segregation.
Mm-hmm.
So actually what happens is, in most of the apartments, whatever the money you get from selling dry waste, that is given back to the housekeepers as an incentive. So usually you don't see them mixing anything in there during the secondary segregation.
So we see that taking a few very simple steps can go a long way in minimizing the waste we send out to landfills. Let us now listen to another champion of waste management, Soumya Raghavan. Soumya grew up in Delhi and came to Bangalore to do her PhD in biochemistry from one of India's premier research institutes. This was more than 20 years ago. She stayed on in Bangalore after her marriage. She worked at a postdoc, worked in a technology firm, and has been involved in issues of waste management now for more than 5 years. In 2012, there was an event on waste management in her apartment complex. Bangalore's waste management experts such as N.S. Ramakant, Anjana Iyer, and a resident of her own apartment complex talked about the importance of segregation.
So I attended this talk, and at the end of it, I remember coming away with, this is all there is to do. Why are people not doing this? Why should this be so hard to do? So subsequently, I think in our community, we decided to follow those rules. We put up notices. But until around September of 2012, we didn't have much compliance inside the complex. So then I started talking to more friends and relatives, others in Bangalore, to find out how they went about it. Do they do this at all in their buildings? So then my sister-in-law, in fact, then told me that you should actually go door to door. It's not just because there is a notice on the board, people may not comply. You should actually talk to them more. That's when the switch happened in my head, is after which I thought that maybe a personal, you know, conveying of this idea that this is very easy to do and you should just do this at your home came to me. And then I called a committee member in the apartments then. And her name is Kritika. She said, okay, we'll go about this. And then we formed a team of volunteers, and each block some of us took up and we went around. So that's when we started doing our waste segregation. And this was going on for a while. We did a fairly good job of it.
After many rounds of communication and also visits to other apartment complexes, including the one where Savita lives, Soumya and her team were able to arrive at a formula to compost their wet waste within their premises. They sent dry waste to a recycler and sanitary waste to a professional manager for incineration. The compost that they generate is used for the garden within their own complex. They also sell a portion of it. Recently, they have started composting leaf litter in the public parks outside their apartment complex. A majority of the waste generated at households is kitchen waste. By treating this at source, a large portion of waste being sent to landfills can be minimized.
When asked why it is that women play a large part in solid waste management, this is what Soumya had to say.
So at home, I guess it's pretty obvious. Most homemakers are women. So they set the routine and discipline in the house, and then from then on, things take off. And a reason I feel many volunteers are women is also because this job of awareness, engaging with collectors, vendors and all, this kind of thing is a very non-corporate, what shall I say, it's a very informal sector. Sometimes it's a language thing, sometimes it's a timing thing, sometimes it's a number of times you engage with them to explain what to do. So I suspect, you know, people who have extra time to spare in the time that these staff usually work, they tend to do better. And also, I think in terms of household, most of the waste still is a very kitchen-driven phenomenon. And I think we're still very heavily female in all these activities at home. Although there is a lot more load sharing now, but it's still a very female-dominated, enterprise. So that's probably why I think there are more women. And I think the interpersonal relationship building is probably a little more female heavy skill. So women tend to engage better with the other section. They tend to be more sensitive perhaps to their needs, and they would think, how would I do this if I were them?
Indu Ramesh shares Soumya's views that women are better communicators and organizers of community. Savita too feels that women play an important role in this sector.
Yes, I mean, whether it is the Solid Waste Management Roundtable, which I'm a member of, and whether it was in my community where we were doing, or in any other community, the number of entrepreneurs that are there in Bangalore or elsewhere have been, yes, predominantly women. One thing, this is my personal opinion, and I would say that, you know, it is they connect to these issues much better, much faster. But at the same time, I would not say that it is a homemaker's job or anything. Many of the women who have done it is while doing their, attending to their profession. You know, they were playing a double role, doing this. Yes, and many women came forward, even though they were working full time, they came forward to volunteer during the weekends. Mm. So there is something to be said about their sense of how they engage their very deep sensibilities to this cause.
Savita says that many men don't think that handling waste is their job. However, she observes that now there are many families that take this task seriously.
But in most cases, what I've seen is wherever there is any family that has actually put its thought into waste segregation, whole family participate. That's the beauty of it. So it sort of shatters many of the barricades, just the very act of segregating.
Savita talks about not just the gender aspect of waste management, but also the caste aspect, which cannot be overlooked in India. She talks of the Paurakarmikas, the city's civic workers contracted by the BBMP. They are engaged in street cleaning and waste collection. We asked what percentage of workers are women.
I don't have exactly the percentage of women that are there as Paurakarmikas, but I presume that it's at least more than 50%, one thing. But what I do know is mostly, almost 70-80% of them come from backward castes, mainly Dalits.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, finally, it is they who are keeping the entire city clean as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know that they don't get paid on time, they have huge number of health issues. Despite all that, it is them who is keeping the city clean.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, predominantly even that is being dominated by women. Yeah. For ages now, upper caste, whoever it may be, they don't think that it is their job to do to take care of their own garbage. Mentally, we already always have a Dalit standing behind us to clean up the muck that we leave behind,
mm-hmm.
right? So it is still the same mindset that is continuing.
With such a mindset, convincing people to segregate garbage is rather difficult. However, segregation at source eases the burden on housekeeping staff and others handling waste.
Every kitchen item separate. Amele adarnalli paper agli enna waste enna idre adu separate martivi. Amele
that was Shanti, a housekeeping staff at the apartment complex where Soumya lives. She has been working in this apartment for 19 years. She says that she sweeps and cleans the apartment complex, keeps the leaf litter separate. She collects waste from the individual flats and separates the different categories of dry waste.
ಯಾವ್ದು ಕಸ ಹೆಂಗೆ ಇರಬೇಕು ಡಿಬೇಟ್ ಮಾಡಿದ್ರೆ ನಮ್ಗೆ ಯಾವ್ದು ಒಳ್ಳೇದಂತ ಅನ್ಸುತ್ತೆ ಅದನ್ನ ಮಾಡ್ಕೊಂಡು ಹೋಗ್ಬೇಕು.
ಸತ್ಯ, ಅನದರ್ ಹೌಸ್ ಕೀಪಿಂಗ್ ಸ್ಟಾಫ್, ಸೇಸ್ ದಟ್ ವೆನ್ ಗಾರ್ಬೇಜ್ ಕಮ್ಸ್ ಸೆಗ್ರಿಗೇಟೆಡ್, ಇಟ್ ಇಸ್ ಈಸಿ ಫಾರ್ ದೆಮ್ ಟು ಅಂಡರ್ಸ್ಟ್ಯಾಂಡ್ ಅಂಡ್ ಮ್ಯಾನೇಜ್ ಇಟ್. They find it easier to further segregate the dry waste into different categories.
ಕೆಲವೊಂದು ಮನೆಯಲ್ಲಿ ಮಿಕ್ಸ್ ಮಾಡ್ತಾರೆ, ಬೈ ವೇ ಇದು ಎಲ್ಲ ಅದರಲ್ಲಿ ಹಾಕಿರ್ತಾರೆ, ನಾವು ನೋಡಿ ತೆಗಿತೀವಿ ಅದನ್ನೆಲ್ಲ.
ಅದೇ ಹೇಗೆ ಅಂದರೆ ಏನು ಯಾವ ಥರ ಮಿಕ್ಸ್ ಮಾಡಿರ್ತಾರೆ?
ಇವ್ರಿಗೆ ಗೊತ್ತಿಲ್ಲದಿದ್ದು ಹುಡುಗರು ಡೇಟ್ ಆಗಿದ್ದು ಅದರಲ್ಲಿ ಹಾಕಿರ್ತಾರೆ.
ರತ್ನಮ್ಮ, ಅನದರ್ ಹೌಸ್ ಕೀಪರ್, ಸೇಸ್ ದಟ್ ಒಕೇಶನಲಿ ಸ್ಯಾನಿಟರಿ ವೇಸ್ಟ್ ಆ್ಯಂಡ್ ವೆಟ್ ವೇಸ್ಟ್ ಗೆಟ್ಸ್ ಮಿಕ್ಸ್ಡ್. For instance, sanitary pads get disposed in the wet waste bin. She thinks that these are mostly done by young girls who may not be aware of waste segregation. Then the housekeepers have to remove it. They say that they inform their supervisors and also talk to the households that do not comply.
In spite of these efforts, huge amounts of trash still end up in landfills. Savita talks of one such landfill. The one in Mavalipura village on the outskirts of Bangalore was fertile land to begin with, 99 acres of it. BBMP took it on lease and started dumping the entire city's waste there. after protests by locals, dumping stopped. But by this time, 4.4 million tons had already been dumped over a period of 10 years.
Extremely toxic waste is landfilled there, and it is there. And each time it rains, it's a nightmare to those people, because all the leachate, all that is actually building up inside, comes out in liquid form form, and then you know it enters the groundwater table, and it is basically, this landfill is actually sitting on a crest, and there are nearly 16 villages surrounding that landfill. Because of this unhindered landfilling, what has happened is all the villages which had wonderful water table earlier, clean water, it's all now completely polluted. And because of water pollution, soil is also polluted, and whatever that grows on top of it. I tell you one thing, one of the farmers told me that before this landfilling, they used to spray pesticides on grape in their vineyards. They would spray pesticides for not more than 2 to 3 times for one crop.
Mm.
Now they are spraying it for 16 to 17 times. That is the level of damage the soil has taken.
Soumya is part of a group that promotes the use of reusable cloth and other such material instead of sanitary napkins. Her apartment complex has a cutlery bank, which people can hire out during functions and reduce the use of disposable cups and plates. A volunteer called Archana Prasad has designed a curriculum called Trashonomics, the economics of trash. They are in talks with the Department of Education to get this into the school curriculum. Soumya feels that much more needs to be done in terms of education, awareness building, and addressing individual houses, corporates, and hospitals, and other large-scale generators of waste.
I think it is the idea of managing, keeping, disposing, and seeing the end of something that you no longer want. So that is a little more involved than pushing, everything under the carpet and calling your room clean. So it's a little more, but there are people who have thought this through, who have made it simple enough for the 70 to 80% to simply follow. So I feel if there is good penalty and enforcement schedules, then it will work. We've seen that to some extent in our ward. Our health officials have been fairly strict in enforcing these rules. But there is still a long way to go.
A long way to go indeed. And many more engaged citizens travelling that distance together. With Manju Venkat, this is Smita Ramanathan saying goodbye from Bangalore, India. We thank Varun Venkat for editorial support. Thank you for listening.
To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Our new website is being rebuilt following a crash, but now you can find some of our most recent editions at wingsradio.org/WordPress. You can also follow daily postings of news about women around the world at facebook.com/wingsradio. Warm thanks to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, WERU-FM, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose work can be found on the website gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer, Frida Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Good morning, this is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder, board operator.
So, from Real Choice Initiative, Alan and Nico.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's good to have you guys in the studio. Can the two of you tell me about Real Choice Initiative?
Real Choice Initiative is a group of people with disabilities helping people with disabilities. So we're a group run by and for people with disabilities. And our main focus is around housing. A lot of people with disabilities struggle to maintain stable housing that's safe and a healthy environment for us to live in, that's accessible and all that sort of thing. So that's where we spend most of our time advocating and working on different policies and helping people on the ground get into places that suit them.
And we also do a lot of work around in-home care, so we support people to know what their options are in terms of the care they receive in their homes.
So, can the two of you give me a backstory on Real Choice Initiative?
Yeah, so a couple years ago, I was doing some work inside group homes, getting to know the people who live in group homes to see what kinds of issues they were dealing with. It turns out that a lot of issues for people who live in group homes they range from not being able to go outside when they want to not being able to eat the foods they want to eat. So I realized that we need to do some work to support people to live in the community and get out of group homes. So I started Real Choice Initiative in 2017.
So can one of you tell me about the successes Real Choice Initiative has had?
Yeah, I'd love to. So Real Choice, we've got a lot of different things we do. So we do work with people on the ground where we do the person-centered planning and help people figure out the nuts and bolts of their particular experience. And then we do also policy work or here in Portland and also at the state level. So I will start out by talking about some of the work that we've done to help get people into independent living situations. So a lot of people with disabilities are, I'm going to use the word stuck in facilities and institutions like nursing homes, group homes, adult foster cares, 24-hour residential facilities, places like that. And we hear from a lot of people that they really would rather live in their own place. They want their own apartment. People might have like a partner, a husband, a wife, you know, a girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever. And they don't get to spend any time with the person, you know, that they care most about in the world. So, you know, there's a lot of different reasons. Some people can't have like pets and things like that in these group facilities. So people want to have their own place for tons and tons of different reasons, but people want to have independence. So we went to Home Forward, which is the housing authority for Multnomah County. And we said, there's a bunch of people that want to have their own places. And right now we can't afford to do that because we've only got $700 or $800 a month with Social Security, and we need to find more ways to do that. So together we went to the federal government, to the HUD, Housing and Urban Development, and said, we have people with disabilities that are stuck in these institutions and they want to be in their own places. And the federal government said, here you go. We've got 99 what they call mainstream vouchers to give to Multnomah County. And Multnomah County had a whole process of setting up of who got to do this and who gets to apply. But essentially the main criteria was you have to be a person who's living in one of these care facilities in order to apply and receive one of these vouchers. They are Section 8 vouchers, which means people pay 30% of their income. And yeah, it just makes it affordable for people with disabilities to live outside of institutions and care facilities. So that is a really exciting thing that happened this last year. The state of Oregon applied for a lot more of these vouchers. There were about $6 million worth of mainstream vouchers that went to the state of Oregon in the last 2 years. So there are people all over the state who are getting to have a chance at living independently, whereas they've always been stuck in a place that they don't really want to be. And a lot of these facilities, and some of them feel kind of like prisons.
They want to be treated like human beings, yeah, exactly, rather than being treated like not human beings.
Yeah, exactly. People deserve to have a life of dignity and independence. One of the other big successes we had this year was we passed our first state law, and this state law says that caseworkers have to at least once a year tell people about the different opportunities that there are for service settings. So that means if you are living in a nursing home or a care facility, your caseworker through the state has to tell you about the other opportunities that there are to live independently. So they can tell you about the mainstream vouchers, they can tell you about other places that might have opportunities for people to live low income and be independent.
Does that also include PAs, which are on the brokerage side of things?
Yes. Yeah, it does. So so the caseworkers through the state, through the Department of Human Services, and the agencies who do pretty much the same kind of thing that the caseworkers at the state do. They manage your care and help you navigate the path of getting services through the state or through the federal government and how it sort of applies in your life. Okay, so we passed this state law, and we were also able to go down to Corvallis, where they had the statewide training for caseworkers and agencies to teach them about how this works and how they can help people with disabilities learn about the different choices of places where they get to live. Yeah. Okay, one of the other big successes that we had this year at Real Choice Initiative, with a lot of lobbying and work from mostly Alan, was that we were able to convince the mayor's office and some of the other commissioners to help us build a system that builds that sets up a stack for people with disabilities to get into the places that fit them the best. So, for example, right now, we don't know where the accessible places are in the city, and we don't know when they're going to be open or when's the last time they were open. We don't know anything about them. We don't even know if they exist at this point. So accessible apartments, yeah. Wheelchair accessible apartments, or apartments that are accessible-ish, I say, where you can get in and out the front door without steps. You can get in and out of the bathroom. You can make most other things work if you can get in the front door and you can get in and out of the bathroom. So so we were able to convince the city elected officials that this is something that needs to be invested in so that we can start figuring out where the places are that are accessible and start keeping a list of where these places are so people can start getting in line to get first dibs on those spots.
Now, isn't there any federal law in place that states that accessibility is a requirement for buildings and stuff like that?
Yeah, there is. Part of the Americans with Disability Act mandates some of these things. Unfortunately, there's no one really keeping tabs on that at all. So what it comes down to is groups like ours, grassroots advocacy groups, to go in and say, hey, here's how we make this happen. We want you to be in compliance, and we need these places, so let's figure this out.
And how, I mean, have buildings been doing that, or do you see that they're not doing that?
Well, that's what we're going to find out. Yeah, that's what we're going to find out from the registry, because it's going to be for the first time starting to keep track of whether or not these apartments or houses or whatever, you know, condos or whatever places there are. It's going to be the first time that we're actually keeping track of those things, because right now we really don't know. We don't think that there are, what is it supposed to be, 20%? 10%? 5%. So we, you know, it's supposed 5%. To be at least 5% of the housing is accessible.
5% seems awfully small.
Right, yeah, because we know that 20% of the national population identifies as someone with a disability. That doesn't count all of the people who might have a hard time with stairs, but they don't like to use the word disabled. So maybe, like, you know, you think of somebody who's had like a knee replacement that they can't really do the stairs very easily, but they really don't like being labeled with the word disability, so they don't say they're disabled. So there's a lot of people who need to have accessible housing. And 5% is just not enough. So we're going to start by figuring out what do we already have? Because once we know that once we have data to say that this is what we have, then we can start setting goals and saying this is where we need to be.
So if I understand it correctly, Real Choice Initiative is doing a study, right?
Yeah, so we were talking about data and how important it is for policymakers, elected officials and stuff to have data so that they can understand where we're at and where we need to go. So Real Choice Initiative is working together with the Portland State School of Government to do the first ever major study of people with disabilities for the city. And we are going to be asking people with disabilities to take a survey and to let us know how things are going for them and where they would like things to be.
How long is the survey?
So, yeah. Yeah, so Alan was saying it's going to take about 20 minutes for most people to do it. We know whenever there's something like that, that sometimes it takes people longer and sometimes, you know, people can go through it really fast. But we're hoping to keep it for most people around 20 minutes. So we've hired a couple of data collectors to go out and talk with people who might not be able to go online and take the survey. We're hoping to get around 350 people with disabilities within the city of Portland. And when we say people with disabilities, anyone that identifies as having a disability is welcome to take the survey. And we also know that, you know, we want to be accessible. So we want to make sure that people who might not be able to read or don't have access to the internet or something like this will have an opportunity to take this survey and to tell us how things are, you know, for them.
And what exactly is the survey getting at? I mean, what are you attempting to pursue? Can you get us some examples of the questions?
Yes, we know that it's not easy for everyone with a disability to participate in local government. So we want to find out why that is.
Yeah.
Why people are not able to go to the park, for instance.
Yeah, and I'm going to just reiterate a little bit what Alan had said, is that the city of Portland started looking at different minority populations, and one of the things about having a disability is that it's the only minority that you can join overnight, right? You could have a really bad accident or have some kind of illness that hits you really suddenly or someone that you care about, and then all of a sudden your life is totally changed and you're disabled. And so the city started saying, why aren't there more people with disabilities participating in the local government? Why aren't people with disabilities up here at City Hall testifying? Why aren't we able to access the parks, access maybe transportation, you know, you name it, maybe the pools, whatever services there are for people to access within this really awesome city that we live in. There's just not a lot of people with disabilities getting to these places. And so the city started kind of scratching their head and saying, why aren't people with disabilities able to access these things?
Well, why did the city just get interested in it at this time? I mean, why not the 1970s or, you know, the 90s or something like that? It seems like they're coming to the ball a little late.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. The similar questions of why people have to sue the city to get the sidewalks fixed.
Yeah.
So they're just getting tired of getting sued, huh?
Yeah, I mean, can I brag about you for a minute? So Alan was a part of a lawsuit. He and two other people had to sue the city of Portland in order to get what we call curb cuts. That's so, you know, when the sidewalk comes to the end of the sidewalk where the street, you know, meets the sidewalk, and making sure that people in wheelchairs can get, and people who can't, you know, people with walkers, people who have a hard time walking over steps, that we can get down off of the sidewalk, cross the street, and get across, you know, the street safely and onto the sidewalk across the street. So Alan and these other folks had to sue the city in order for the city to be compliant with this this mandate, this federal law, part of the Americans with Disability Act. So the good news is Alan and the two other activists, they sued the city, and the city is now having to put in, I think it's 12,000, I'm sorry, over the next 12 years, they have to put in 18,000 curb cuts. So you may have seen, you know, when you're driving down the street or on the bus or, you know, going for a walk or something, that there's, you know, all these cones around the corner of these different intersections, and they're putting in these different curb cuts with the little yellow pads with the bumps on them. That's so that people who can't see can feel where the sidewalk is ending and can safely cross the street. So those are going in all over the city, and that's because of Alan and these two other activists that sued the city. Right. Yeah. And like Alan's saying, it's a good sign that the city's starting to prioritize our community. And yeah, it's unfortunate that it hasn't happened sooner. And at the same time, we have to remember that a lot of people with disabilities, up until fairly recently, were all kind of locked up in different places where they were quarantined in places like Fairview. And there were different facilities around the state, but essentially people with disabilities, with severe and profound disabilities, we weren't out in public doing anything because we were all stuck in these, you know, these state hospitals and big institutions. So, you know, I will give them the benefit of the doubt and say they're catching up. They're, you know, a little late to the game, like you said. And, you know, we'll take what we can get. Better late than never.
Sounds like we need to sue the federal government if we want to get a fair shake in the next 4 years.
Well, that's a big chunk to chew off. There's a lot of work to be done, and we definitely encourage people, if they are disabled or have other people in their lives that are disabled and or have, you know, serious health concerns that affect their lives, to please consider joining us at Real Choice Initiative so that we can find out what we need and how we're going to get there together. So I'll just say our website is www.realchoiceoregon.com, and you will be able to reach out to us and say, you know, I have this thing going on and I really need help with it, and we will do everything we can to work with you to figure it out.
And we also have a link to the study.
Yes, and we'll also have a link to the study. To the survey, that's right. The survey for the study for the city of Portland. So, yeah, so you can go to our website. We've got other things on there. We'll tell you about our upcoming events. There's a short documentary interview on there about Real Choice Initiative. We just hope that people will be able to have more access to what they need. And like I said, we want to work together to figure it out.
So what is the future of Real Choice Initiative?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So the next upcoming thing for people to do will be the survey. And again, realchoiceoregon.com is where you can find that. We'll also be trying to circulate it on other various social media sites and putting flyers around town. And like we said, we've hired some data collectors that will also be out helping people to take the survey. If you take the survey, or maybe I should say when you take the survey, you will hear about a town hall that we're going to be doing near the end of the project. And that the town hall will be a facilitated conversation where we will share the information that we gathered from the survey. And we will make sure that, you know, we didn't miss anything and hear from everybody about what they think. And then after the town hall, we will gather all that information up, and we're going to have a presentation for the city council in June.
I would be interested in taking this survey.
Yeah.
So I'm just kind of curious, for all those who are interested in taking the survey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is it mostly just finding it through your website? Do you guys have like maybe a Facebook page or a phone number people can call or anything else like that?
Yeah, good question. So yes, definitely through realchoiceoregon.com. We'll have it posted there. We also have a Real Choice Initiative Facebook page. We'll post it there. Alan and myself and other people, we're hoping we'll share the study the survey link on their social media pages. So we're going to try to get it out that way. We're going to be posting flyers all over town at different places where people with disabilities go to hang out. Like there are different dances for people with disabilities or places where we go to try to find work or, you know, maybe food pantries, you know, different places where people with disabilities go. We're going to have flyers all over town, and then we will have two data collectors that are going to be out and about helping people to take the survey again for someone who maybe doesn't read or maybe someone who can't see or people who don't have access to the internet. We'll have people out and about helping to take the survey.
Is there any chance that you guys might actually be attending a few of those events, such as Off the Couch or Club Impact, and trying to gather up surveys that way as well?
Yeah, we're gonna take our crew and we're gonna go out to as many things, I think, as we possibly can, because again, we wanted to try to get to at least 350 people in the city of Portland with disabilities to hear about your experiences and what's going on for you and what you feel is a priority going forward. So yeah, we're gonna get out and talk to as many people as we can.
All right.
And then one of the other events that we have coming up, it's a monthly event. We have what's called an Independent Living Coffee Hour, and it is the fourth Saturday of every month from 2 to 4 over at 2475 Southeast Ladd Avenue on 20th and Division. And that is a time for people with disabilities and other folks in their lives, maybe, you know, family members or care workers, to come together and we hang out and have coffee together. We get some pastries and just talk about what's going on for us and share tips and talk about, you know, what we need help with or, you know,
sometimes you also find out resources and other things like that, because people are sitting there talking and interacting with each other and sharing their problems, and mm-hmm. somebody else may have a solution to somebody else's problem.
Absolutely, yeah. So we get together, and this is the same for a lot of minority communities. We learn how to get through the difficulties in our lives by helping each other. And, you know, I might hear you talking about, well, I've been having this really difficult time with my transportation needs and I don't know what to do. And I might say, well, I know about this resource or, you know, something like this. So we share what we know with each other so that we can all live better lives together. So the coffee hour, sometimes it's like very unstructured like that, and we just kind of hang out and talk to each other. Sometimes we have a meeting where we'll say, hey, it seems like everyone here is talking about the same problem. Let's all talk about it together. And then we have a facilitated conversation where we discuss something that's happening and try to come up with solutions and action plans to change it.
Does that ever occur outside of that further interaction? Does that ever occur outside the coffee hour?
Yeah, it does sometimes. So, for example, when the Affordable Care Act was being, you know, trying to be dismantled, we got together with a bunch of people with disabilities, and we all went together to do an action to try and impact that so that we could keep our health care. So, you know, sometimes if there's something really big happening, we will work together and organize around something very specific. So, you know, as things continue on, there's a lot of stuff for us to work on. So we kind of figure out, you know, what's the thing that we can work on the most. And that's part of why Real Choice Initiative focuses so much on housing, because even if you had the best healthcare, you had good transportation, you had decent food, you have enough clothes, you have all these different things, you can, you know, you can get to a school or all of this stuff. If you don't have a place to live, everything falls apart, because you can't live well without a place to live and uh-huh. a place to live that is what that suits you, that's what you need. So that's part of why we really focus on housing. But there, you know, we will work on other things too. It's kind of whatever we need to do, we will see if we can do it and throw our effort towards it. So we want to help facilitate getting people matched up with care workers and people with disabilities, so people can get a good job and then the people with disabilities can have the independence that we deserve and want. So we'll have another care mixer coming up soon. We just had one. And we'll have another one in May. And again, please go to realchoiceoregon.com to find out more information about it. It's at the same place we mentioned before, 2475 Southeast Division, or sorry, Southeast Ladd Avenue. And yeah, if you or someone is disabled and wants to have access to a care worker, that's how we're going to do it.
Sounds like Real Choice Initiative is a real advocate for the disabled community.
That's right. Yeah, we try our best to do what we can to make our lives better. And again, it's for people. It's a group run by people with disabilities for people with disabilities. So it's not that we're just we want to do a good thing for the world and help this community that we don't know anything about. We are this community. We need this help too. We're working on these things because we don't want to get stuck in nursing homes. So it makes a real difference when it's something that's coming from the people that need that stuff.
Uh-huh. Thank you, Alan and Nico from Real Choice Initiative. I hope to have you guys in the studio once again sometime in the future.
Yeah. Thanks, John. This was fun. Thank you. And thanks, Dina, to our editor and producer.
Oh, yes. Thank Dina for our board operator.
You got it.
This was fun. Thanks, John.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kbu.org.
Also, we're always looking for fun, inexpensive things to do out in the community. Go to disabilityjustice@kboo.org to contact us and give us your ideas. Thank you.
KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community.